So as I was saying when we began, I just got back from some sabbatical time, actually 2.5 months away, and I did what I generally do during sabbatical time, which is spend some time in deep retreat, in silence and in solo self-retreat. It's kind of my style these days after spending more than a decade in the big center of sitting retreats there. They're great too. But at some point, things transition. So I just had a cabin in the woods for 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's a good way to practice. Mm-hmm. You know, at a certain point, don't do it prematurely. You know, I've been sitting these long retreats for 20 years, so. And then I came back home and took 3 days to pack my bags and took off on an airplane to Colombo, Sri Lanka. Never been, didn't know much about it, but I feel called. I feel called into the cultures that Buddhism was born out of, to actually go back to the roots, so that then when I come back and I'm sitting here with you and we're making it extremely American, extremely 2016, there's some ground there. And I know some of you have felt that call and you've gone with Dennis on pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya, or you've gone yourself somewhere where the Dharma is alive and a culture where it's been alive longer than it has been here in the U.S. But hey, it's been alive here in the U.S. for some time now. You know, we're sinking our own roots, and I'm really happy about that too. So really, I go on these sabbaticals and I go into retreat every year, and it's an annual thing for me. Those of you that know me know that's it's an annual thing. I sit 1 month, 2 months, 3 months of silent retreat every year, and I have since I was in my early 20s. And it's really time to look and see, who am I without all this? And as I teach more and more and more over these years, I've been teaching in more than 15 years, but it's gotten, well, a little bit bigger because the interest is growing. This is a live time for people to come to communities like this and say, hey, who am I without all the rest of this? And what is going on here? And what is the moment? If I turn off the phone, if I turn off the internet, if I stop doing everything that we do to miss the moment. But for me, it's an even bigger question of who am I when I'm not in community? And so it's actually an inner and outer journey. To go into deep retreat in the silence, there's no one. There's no one to reflect me back except this crazy mind, mm-hmm. You know, except this awakening mind. And then I go to countries that I've never been or places that I've never been, and nobody knows my name. And even when I tell them my name, it's not the name that you know. Because when I go to places like Thailand or Sri Lanka or India or Nepal or wherever it is I go, it's very hard to say TH. And it's very hard to say the word or the sound R. And so over there, I'm Heda. What's your name? Heda, where are you from? U.S. Oh, America. Like, oh, right, America. Yeah, interesting what we think about all these places and who we are. Is there some sort of feedback there? In the
Did you knock it out or something?
I haven't touched a thing.
It went out. Can I go up there real quick?
Yeah, let's play with it so people can hear. Shift in the force.
When we were in India, and we went to this soaking tablet place, we said we're in U.S. Hollywood.
Right, U.S. Hollywood, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm
Brian. So, we get it? Yeah.
Not so much enthusiasm next time, okay?
Yeah, it's just too much enthusiasm. You know, my energetic probably didn't do anything, but I did. One of my many teachers actually had such a powerful energetic. It was one of my teachers from Asia that often clocks would, or watches, wristwatches would die when he'd get in the room. Like the electronics would go wonky. It's very interesting. If I had that power, then we wouldn't have to turn our cell phones off. But I don't. Oh well. So then I get to go out in the world and be nobody, which is a really nice thing to be. Because I get to see pieces of myself that I can't see when I'm in this culture. I get to see pieces of myself that I can't see when I'm in leadership. And all of us have circumstances that make it so that we can't see parts of ourselves, or roles that we take where we have to put part of ourselves in the background or we can't quite see. And really the invitation of the spiritual path is to have an ongoing awareness of what we can see, what we can't see, and how to constantly be exploring these places. You know, in the midst of a life and when we take a night and come here and turn it all off. You know? Hopefully we'll turn it all off. This is the funniest thing during the meditation.
Yeah.
I've never heard that particular style of phone go off. It was something about...
It was Siri saying,
she said something. And I thought, yeah, everybody's mind's saying something right now. Yeah. My goodness, Siri is having like psychic powers, awareness that somebody said something. We sit here so quietly, right? We're still, our eyes are closed. I can't wait till the technology is available. I also live in fear of when the technology is available. That you can put a megaphone to my head and hear what's going on. We're not looking forward to that technology. So I went off, and you know, the whole spiritual path is this piece about kind of going off on a journey, an inner journey, an outer journey, and then the return. And we go inside, and then we return, and it's cyclical. Mm-hmm. The monastics do it on the seasons. I like to sit retreat in the winter, call my long retreats in the winter lay women's rains retreats, because the monastics sit, the Western monastics anyway, when it rains in the winter, and in Asia they sit in the summer, rains then. So somebody sent me this poem yesterday by Naomi Sheep Nye, and I just love her. And it kind of speaks to where I am coming out of all this. And it's called Fresh. It's from You and Yours. She says, to move cleanly, needing to be nowhere else, wanting nothing from any store, to lift something you already had and set it down in a new place. Awakened eye, seen freshly, what does that do to the old blood moving through its channels? Awakened eye seen freshly, what does that do to the old blood moving through its channels? It's the first time I've read that out loud, because I only received it yesterday. And so the reflection that arose as I read it was actually my first pilgrimage, my first trip to India, which was not so many years ago. And I remember this quality of the eyes waking up outside of conditioned perception. But here's what it looked like, okay? So I'm in India, I've never been in India before. And so I'd be on the street, and something would be moving along my line of vision. And the headline that I would give it is, what is it exactly that I'm looking at? I had no idea what I was seeing with my eyes. My eyes were functioning perfectly, and yet I could not, the perception wouldn't arise because there wasn't the memory, there wasn't the conditioning to be able to put a label on it. And so sometimes it would be something like an entire family on a motor scooter, you know? The dad, the mom, and three kids, and one kid was like this, and another kid was up here, and one was sort of hanging off the back, and then something like this long, sideways. I mean, you just when you look at a road and something this long sideways, you're not thinking, what is it that I'm looking at exactly? No, that's illegal here. And, of course, what we discover is illegal is a concept. I discovered that flying into New Delhi that first trip, because I flew in, it was midnight, you know, you've been traveling for like, I don't know, 30-something hours, and you get in the cab and you hope it's all going to work out to get to wherever it is that you've gotten your online reservation, and you don't know where it is, and they're just running every single red light as if it was nothing. And you go, oh, right, these are conditions. Oh, interesting. Some countries, people mostly pay attention to these things. It's helpful. It's helpful, but it's not the whole thing. So we get to see freshly. We meditate, we close our eyes, and it's like seeing freshly. Wow. How many hundreds of millions of breaths have we had in a life? And we don't pay attention to them unless we meditate, unless someone we love is dying, and we're sitting with them, and we're breathing with them, and we're breathing for them, and we're breathing with them, and all of a sudden it's really, really alive, that experience of breath, externally. And the Buddha talked about how we can be aware of our own breath, of breath outside, of things internally, externally. Or when a baby's born, right? And that breath just takes a little bit too long before it comes out, and we're all holding our breath, and then it's like, ah! It's like that sometimes when we meditate. You noticed? It's like we get lost in thought so deeply that it's as if we forgot to breathe, and all of a sudden we realize that we're back, and it's just, whoa, I'm here. What a journey I just went on. Where was I? You take that deep breath. I'm here. I'm here. So, Sri Lanka in late March, mid-April. How many of you have lived on either the East Coast or the South of this country, somewhere where it was like, it got very, very hot and very, very humid? I'm just curious. Show of hands.
Where's that?
Oh, wow, most of you. Okay, so I'm a native Californian. I was born like a mile from the Pacific Ocean. I've lived my whole life in California. Yes, I've spent time in Asia, and I've spent time in Asia in monsoon. So I'm no stranger to heat or humidity. But, okay, this was Sri Lanka in late March to late April. And not only that, but Sri Lanka was in the midst of perhaps a global warming influenced massive heat wave. And it was the same heat wave that came in through southern China and killed so many people. And, you know, so it moved through the whole area. And it was so hot in Sri Lanka that even the Sri Lankans were suffering. And they'd come up to us and say, wow, this is terrible. It's so hot. Are you okay? And I'd look at them and think, you know, I was just barely okay until you as a local told me that you're not okay. And now I'm really not okay. You know, it's this close, that edge between suffering and not suffering. It's this close, that edge between shooting the second arrow of, you know, first arrow was, this isn't great, this isn't pleasant. The second arrow is, I can't stand this, it's unbearable. And so it really does matter the company we keep and the conversations we have. Because honestly, if they hadn't kept saying, this is terrible, are you okay? I would have had more opportunities to just relax and go, pretty miserable, I'm okay. So I take myself to be a person who doesn't like heat. Okay. And not only that, but I happen to have a physical structure that literally, medically, is sensitive to heat. So I can even make a case that heat is difficult. You know, and a doctor would back that up. A little tweak in my system. But there's still choice. There's still choice. And so, kind of paint a picture for you. One of my favorite places in Sri Lanka, I have to relax before I say the title of the town, because if I don't relax, it will come out incorrectly. And that's a very interesting metaphor, because there's certain things that we can actually completely come into harmony with and manifest if we relax. and trust that everything can move forward. But if we get uptight, it's just all a mess. You know, think of what your thing is like that. So for me, it's saying the title of this town, which I must have said incorrectly at least 50 times before I relaxed enough to manifest it. So the name of this town is Annapurna. And Annapurna was an early capital in Sri Lanka, way, way back. And it's the place where actually the great, great grandmother Bodhi tree lives. So we tend to think of the Bodhi tree in Bogaya as the Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree that Siddhartha sat under to have his awakening experience and then share it with all of us all the way down through here. And the answer is yes, it is the Bodhi tree. But in fact, a clipping was taken from that Bodhi tree in Bogaya, India, several hundred years later, during the time of King Ashoka. And it was taken to the seat, the capital seat of Sri Lanka, and planted there. Which is really good news, because some of us know what happened next, which was the Bodhi tree in Bodhgaya died. So then, a clipping was taken from the Bodhi tree in Sri Lanka and transplanted back to Bodhgaya. So then you start to ask, like, which one is the Bodhi tree? Which one is the real Bodhi tree? Does it even matter? Which one's the real me, the one that can't do heat, or the one that's relaxing in the heat? The answer is it's all interconnected. They're all influencing each other. And so then in the experience of the influence, how do we want to meet it? So I've spent some time at the Bodhi tree in Bogaya, India. The Bodhi tree, and I know some of you have too, the Bodhi tree in Sri Lanka is different. It's not in great shape, number one. And, you know, if you wanted to worry about something, you could just worry about, like, uh-oh, I hope that Bodhi tree in Sri Lanka doesn't die. Because it really wasn't looking so good. But here's the thing. That Bodhi tree, the original Bodhi tree, is surrounded by its descendants, which are thriving. And it's like, at some point, where do the roots meet? So there's this beautiful canopy. It took a really long time to actually identify which one was the real Bodhi tree. And you start to wonder, does it matter? Does it matter that the leaf that fell down off the tree that somebody picked up and gave me that I was really grateful for, that I managed to transport all the way home without breaking? That was quite a feat. Does it matter that it wasn't from probably the oldest one? So the image is this. It's 8:30 in the morning. And I'm walking. I'm walking to this temple, to this Bodhi tree. It's a much simpler place, less people than Bogaya, India. And my shirt and my pants are already completely stuck to my body as if there's no separation, right? And I'm walking barefoot across a courtyard because you have to take your shoes off long before the Bodhi tree. By 10 a.m., you can't even do it, that walk, without burning your feet because of the sun. But the problem is that you come back after 10 a.m. So I just told you that you couldn't do it. But in fact, I did it every day. So what do we tell ourselves we can't do? What do we tell ourselves we can't do that we do anyway? And in that case, I did it anyway because of the love. I couldn't leave. I wasn't going to leave early so that I didn't, like, hurt my feet. Sometimes we're tougher than we think we are. And I learned that when I travel in Asia. And I learned that when I sit quietly alone for 5 weeks, you know, with nothing but my own mind to keep me company. It was a really good retreat this year. The mind was a very good companion. But sometimes it's not like that. Some years it's not like that. It just depends. And some days our minds are terrible company. We wouldn't wish our minds on anybody else. And other times our minds are the best company ever. Like an ally, family, or good friend. It's always changing. So I'm walking across this courtyard barefoot. Just, you know, hair, like your scalp streams sweat. It's basically like taking a shower without taking a shower. So a lot of you guys know this because you live different places. And I'd get there and we'd sit under these trees, the Bodhi tree and the descendants of the Bodhi tree. And it was a place of community practice. There were monastics there and they would come through and do these amazing ceremonies and it was very inspiring. But they would come and they would go. You know, the same way the kind of like the drama comes and goes in our life. It's like, oh, here's the main event coming through my day, and then it goes. And what's left? And what's left under this bow tree were the people, just the community. Everybody was there, all ages. And the practice under this Bodhi tree and under other Bodhi trees that I visited in Sri Lanka, some people would sit quietly, but the main practice was chanting. And so, you know, from this size to this size to just the elder who can barely walk but still somehow manage to have her shoes off. Now, I don't know how. Everybody's chanting. And they're chanting in the old language that the teachings were translated into, or when they were first written down. Oh, and that's a whole other story. I don't know if we'll get to that one, maybe another time. So chanting the Pali, and they chant really fast. And so I was hard-pressed to keep up, because here in America, well, we weren't raised on these chants, and so we chant them slower. So I was listening to them, trying to discern, do I know any of these chants? And it was an interesting reflection, because one of the things that I realized being there with the community was that I had given something up. And I had somewhat of consciousness about this thing I had given up, but not full consciousness until I sat down with the people and they're chanting. Over the last 10 years, as I've been teaching more and more and more and more, I've been deeply committed to, in the teaching, being inclusive and being accessible. And so one of a thousand things that I've altered in order to support those qualities is I've reduced and then sometimes eliminated any Pali words in my teaching. And I've done that so that when people come in new, there's not a jargon that they feel like, I don't know what's going on here. So it's a wholesome thing to do. It came out of sincere intention, but something got lost. And what got lost for me was the Pali language. If you don't use it, you lose it. This is why we're always saying, if you can sit every day, or if you can practice mindfulness every day, please do. Because it gets rusty, and we lose access. And so I'm sitting there listening to these chants, and there's two things going on through my whole system. One is actually experiencing the loss and actually the grief. Because for me, when I came into meditation and I first heard that language, it was like hearing something I already knew. I'm not real good with languages, but that one picked right up, no problem. And of course, it's a dead language like Latin, so we don't speak it. I learned it through chanting. And then the other thing was just like this joy. And like a wave of freshness, because chants came back to me that I didn't even know I still knew. And if you asked me what they are, I wouldn't be able to tell you what they are. But if you start chanting them, they move right through. And that's how I learned the chants, actually. I never got a chant sheet or anything. I mostly learned them around monastics. And what I learned was, in order to manifest them, it's the same thing I had to do saying the word Anuruddha. What I had to do was completely relax and let go of trying to figure out how it's supposed to sound or remember what comes next, and just allow the mouth to make the sounds. And the mouth knows through repetition. I think our meditation practice is a little bit like this, and it's the part we don't talk about. Right? Because what we tend to talk about are the techniques. Americans are very techniquey. And notice this when I leave the country, because I go to certain other places on the planet and people aren't quite as interested in having five different ways to do one thing. They're just not. There's a different orientation. And this is one of many different orientations. So first, it is helpful to know the techniques, right? To know that when the mind is crazy busy with thoughts, we want to come back to what we call the primary object, whether it's the breath, or sounds coming and going, or scanning the attention through the body, or the metta phrases, the loving kindness phrases, right? That's helpful technique. It's helpful to know all the different ways that we can be mindful, and some of us like mental noting, and others of us, it doesn't work at all, and we start to find our way, and we develop our art of practice. But once we've learned enough techniques, and we have enough confidence in the art of our own practice, knowing when it's time to narrow down, knowing when it's time to open up, knowing when we need to shift the attitude of mind into more benevolence, knowing when we need a dash of patience. You know, it's like cooking a good meal. There's more. And we know that there's more. And the more falls under, it's less about concepts, it's less about language, it's less about what we can point to as something. And it's more about a deep, deep trust. Can I trust that when I'm sitting here in this community of people, all ages, and they're chanting, and their chants that I knew by heart but I no longer know, and then, oops, they do that line a little bit differently. Does the mind jump and like try to like figure it out and grab onto it and all this, or does it just go with the flow? This is this world. No, it's a world where we're listening. We're deeply listening to something that isn't about figuring it out. It isn't about the person figuring it out. It isn't about manifesting anything. It isn't about getting it right. It isn't even about whether we like it or don't like it, whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable, or whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. Because, by the way, after we would sit under the Bodhi tree and chant for a while, it was time for puja in the temple. The temple's set up just like Bodh Gaya, because I know some of you have been there, where the tree, the Bodhi tree is in the back, and then in front of it is a small temple. So we go later in the morning for chanting puja, because it's all about chanting. So I know you've been places where it's standing room only. So this was sitting room only. And what I mean by that is that you're sitting, and of course personal space is a little different in Sri Lanka than it is in America. So you're in there sitting, and from the doorway and even outside the doorway and the whole temple, you're just like this. You're kind of curled up, and there's just enough room for your one, two sits bones, and that's it. Just the sits bones. Oh, and by the way, these cushions, forget it. We're on concrete, okay? And you're sitting there for like an hour on balancing on your sits bones, hoping that you don't bruise your sits bones, and then realizing you just got to let go of the hope and the fear, because there's just nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. And so you're in there, and you're balancing, and you're sitting, and it isn't about if you're comfortable or not, and it isn't about whether you like it or not. It's about a deeper pulsation that's happening. So there's a single body that we can be aware of, and then there's the us body. I don't know if you ever do this when you're here at SIM. I'd be curious to hear at the end if anybody does, what their experience is. Sitting here on a Thursday night or coming to a day long, it's like, oh, you do those things that you do. Maybe this is one of the things you do. But you know, you probably adjust your posture, you make sure there's enough uprightness in the spine, enough relaxation so that you're not in additional agonizing pain the whole time. Some of it we can't prevent, but some of it we can. And then you're probably being with your primary object and doing your thing. But do you ever actually open it up not even in loving kindness practice, just open it up to include the breath body of the community, to include the physical body, the earth body of all of us here. And it's like we can actually feel that space, this body and this body, this mind and this mind. One of the founding teachers of insight meditation in this country, Joseph Goldstein, is fond of saying, if you don't like your thoughts, just imagine they came from the person behind you, because they might as well have. Okay? This body, this body, this mind, heart, this mind, heart, this breath. And then we fill that space and that understanding, that direct experience, with benevolence. And sometimes we call that metta. So it's a very different way of practicing that connectedness than the technique of, here's me, here's my metta muse, and here are my phrases. Now, don't get me wrong, I love that technique. I have probably put in a cumulative year of retreat in my life using that technique. It's great. And there's times for technique, and there's times for the technique to just be the ground that doesn't even need to be used for something else. And that's what I'm talking about. Because when it's that hot, and it's that sticky, and you're that dehydrated, and you're so far outside of what you know, and kind of what you're familiar with, the techniques fall away. It gets really close to the bone. You get to see. I got to see, like, what's this practice made of if I'm not techniquing it? So the first time I started chanting with the community, they're chanting. I was very shy. I don't like to be invasive in a culture I'm not familiar with. But I just couldn't help myself, you know. I love chanting. A lot of you guys know that. I love to sing. So I couldn't help myself. So I started chanting fairly quietly. And I actually have a big voice, but I was pretty quiet. I didn't want to disturb or anything. And what happened was everybody around me stopped chanting and looked at me. And I sort of was aware of that. I kept my eyes closed, but I was totally aware of it. And the thought that went through my mind is, well, I'm just going to keep chanting, and I'm going to hope that they pick it up again. And sure enough, they did. And then I was family, because I was no longer the farang, the foreigner, coming through to kind of gaze up at the tree and take a photo. And, you know, you watch people come through and do that. And, you know, seeds are being planted there. You know, we don't know how those people's lives are going to move forward. But in the moment, it looks pretty touristy. And they realized, oh, this is family. This is one of us. And they started coming up and kind of, you know, are you Buddhist? Yes. You know, and you don't have to be a Buddhist to be here, but when you're in a Buddhist country and you want them to know that you meditate, you just say yes. And you don't worry about the identity of Buddhist or Buddhism. You just say yes, because it's about the connection. And if you say no, I just meditate, they may not know enough English, or they may not know what that means. So it's about the connection. I said, yes, yes. And they started pointing to my protection cords and showing me theirs. And, you know, it's like I got adopted. It's a privilege. They started saving me a seat for my two little sitz bones in the temple. Seriously, it was really dear. Just enough room. So part of why we practice, one of a thousand reasons why we take the spiritual path, is so that we can be available to questions that we may not have had before. Available to questions arising that may be fresh. So we'll go back to Naomi's poem, right? And before Siddhartha sat under the Bo tree in what is now Bodh Gaya, India, one of the important kind of impetuses of him doing that was that he had, of course, moved around India, meditated with many teachers, learned a ton, received a ton, totally matured his spiritual path, and yet, there's always that and yet, right? Look for the moments when the and yet drops away, and it's just enough. They happen. But a lot of the times it's and yet. And so for Siddhartha, it was an and yet moment. He'd done all this concentration practice, all this purification practice, everything he could possibly think of, and yet. And a fresh question arose in his mind. And the fresh question was this: might there be another way? Might there be another way? Because the way that it's going has led to some progress, but there's still the and yet. How do I move beyond the and yet? Or maybe it isn't even moving beyond. Maybe I'll pull out the sutta now. Why not? I'm supposed to offer a sutta. Here's a sutta. I love this sutta. So when I'm in Sri Lanka, we're hitting the pause button. We'll go back. When I go to Asia, I'm often practicing with communities in the morning and studying in the afternoon, and that's what I did in Sri Lanka. This was one of the main texts that I studied. It's called The Island, and it's by two people who are dear to my heart, Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro. They wrote this when they were co-abbots at Abhayagiri Monastery in Mendocino. And they've both been mentors to me when I was in teacher training, and we've had a lot of good times together, a lot of family retreats, a lot of teen retreats, a lot of good Dharma conversations over the years. So they wrote this book, and this book is an anthology on the Buddha's teachings on Nibbana, or awakening. Okay. So we've got the and yet. How do we move beyond the and yet? So there'd be a lot of answers to that question, but here's one. And it's the Buddha's answer to a question. So there's lots of questions in this traditions. Mm-hmm. So Buddha, where do the four great elements, the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element cease without remainder? How do we move beyond the and yet? Because even at the point of and yet, we've made tremendous progress on the spiritual path. Then what? So the first thing that the Buddha said is he said, you know, you shouldn't ask your question in this way. Where do the four elements, the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, cease without remainder? Instead, this is how the question should be put. Okay? Where do earth, water, fire, and air no footing find? Where are long and short, small and great, fair and foul? Where are name and form wholly destroyed? Name and form, body and mind, wholly destroyed. Yeah, and I just imagine this group of practitioners, like, on their sits bones, at the edge of their non-existent seats, because they're on the ground. Like, what is he going to say? And am I going to get it? And what does it mean to get it? What does it mean to not get it? I'm full of questions tonight. Yeah, because there's something more than getting it or not getting it. There's something more than, do I like it or not? Is it pleasant or not? Am I comfortable or not? There's something more than the and yet. And the answer is, where consciousness is signless, boundless, all luminous, that's where earth, water, fire, and air find no footing. There, both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, there, name and form, body and mind, are wholly destroyed. With the cessation of consciousness, all this is destroyed. Thus the Buddha spoke, and everyone was delighted and rejoiced at his words. Okay, so what if you were delighted and rejoiced even if you had no idea what that meant? What if you just went, cool, there's something beyond what I understand? Isn't it a wonderful thing that there's something more than what I understand, what I can control? I. It's a wonderful thing. It brings out the freshness. It brings out the potential. And so really, in asking all those questions that I just asked, and for some of you that was probably annoying, why doesn't she just get to the point? That is the point. You know? It's just a very ordinary expression, all those questions I just asked, of this exact same thing. You know? It's like beyond the answers, there's a space. Thinking of that Rumi poem, you know, beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. I'll meet you there. So, you know, obviously I could have given a whole hour talk just on that. But I didn't, because I want to talk about Sri Lanka. But actually, the whole talk was about this. Because I started with where perception fails. What is it exactly I'm looking at? Where perception fails, there's a gap. And in that gap, our habits aren't in the foreground. Something else is available. And the something else that can shine forth isn't about a label. It isn't about an identification. And it can be extremely luminous. And it's completely outside of space and time. And we don't have to know what that means. I have no idea what it means, but I know it in direct experience. And so we can just relax and say, Anuruddhaparna. And we can just relax and be available to the qualities of boundlessness, of luminousness, of not labeling it. Me not labeling it. And then everything's just allowed to be exactly as it is, in its conditioned suchness, in its awakeness, in its fullness. And I get to walk back across that courtyard way too late in the morning, barefoot, and watch. What's the relationship with reactivity during this walk across the courtyard? Am I hopping? Am I tightening the bottoms of my feet as if I could possibly prevent the burning sensation? What's the quality of mind as I'm walking across this courtyard with too much burning feet and too much sweaty hair and too much of everything that I don't like? Am I in the I don't like? My early teachers from Thailand lived in southern Thailand, very, very hot. And he used to say, well, you know, it gets very, very hot, very, very sweaty. My body is hot, but I am not hot. No. So it's like your day was super stressful. I'm so sorry. No. I wish it was otherwise. You wish it was otherwise. Experience is stressful. Do I have to be so caught up in the stress? Or can I just let it vibrate through? And so sometimes I walked across and was hopping and hating it, and other times I walked across at ease. And we do that every day. We walk across our days, hopping and hating it, and ease, and hopping and hating it, and ease, and everything in between. We're looking for the grounded place of no footing. Or another way of putting that is, it's like we're looking for ground, but in fact, it's just groundless. And we're looking and we're looking and we're looking. But can we actually ground in the groundlessness itself? Things are changing. Everything that gives us our sense of safety is uncertain. But can we actually just ground in the fleetingness of what does give me some container and some safety today, knowing that the rug can be pulled out at any time, and it is. Yeah. And it's not fun, and we have support, and we have tools, and may we make it, right? This great meta phrase, may we make it through this moment, may we meet this moment as a friend, whatever it is. So that consciousness that I talk about as pure awareness, through which everything is moving. And sometimes it gets very, very clouded over, that pure awareness. But it can shine forth. And it doesn't need Sri Lanka. It doesn't need a long retreat. Those are helpful conditions, but it doesn't need that. Right here. Just a space bigger than your body. Right here. Just a space bigger than whatever story you're telling yourself right now. It's fun to come back to quotes after being away a couple months. They're all new. So it's from Ajahn Sumedho. Very simple. Yesterday is a memory. Tomorrow is the unknown. Now is the knowing. So this question, what do we believe about ourselves, which isn't always so? It's a simple thing. I discovered that I believed about myself that I was a person that couldn't tolerate the heat and couldn't stand the heat, and it absolutely wasn't true. But the heat was the muse. The heat was the muse to illuminate the question and to see through the question. It could have been anything. What do I believe about myself that isn't always so? And then all of a sudden there's a window, and we see that there's more. For me, it was just the heat. For you, it's something else. So that's what I have to offer for reflection. Mm-hmm.